Certainly have been busy. The last time we talked, it was the book before. It was the Black Dahlia.
Was it? We didn't do the Big Nowhere?
I don't think we did. So you can get up a little.
Yeah. Kind of watch. Are we talking now? Are we on the air?
We're just taping it, so yeah. I take it and turn it around.
Yeah.
I had it there later. I think we did the Black. Maybe we did do.
The Big Nowhere would be 4 years ago. The Black Dahlia 5.
Could have been.
Yeah. It's been a while.
And then the last time I saw you, you were signing books on the New Yorkers Book Country Fair.
Yes, which is coming up again on Sunday. I'll be there again.
I don't want you to think too much about it. I'm just going to watch it.
Okay.
So, at any rate, you've been certainly busy. You haven't been resting on your laurels, so to speak.
No, no. I'm increasing the ante with each and every book.
Ante?
The ante.
Upping the ante.
I'm upping it.
Upping the ante.
Yes.
And you said you were with a better publisher. Knopf certainly is.
Knopf is the king of publishers. Not only that, I'm the demon dog of American literature, and they are the home of the borzoi. So you get a dog in the spine of your book.
Of course, the Mysterious Press wasn't anything to sneeze at.
Mysterious Press was no slouch either. But Knopf, you know, it's the king of publishers.
It really is.
Yeah.
I guess you would consider The Black Dahlia your breakthrough book.
It was my breakthrough book and the first novel in my L.A. quartet. And the L.A. quartet spans 1947 to 1959 in Los Angeles. And my new book, White Jazz, published by Knopf, is the concluding volume.
You certainly have a preoccupation with Los Angeles in that period, don't you?
It is the focus of my richest and darkest and deepest curiosities.
Well, of course, I know a lot of your background, having talked to you before, and there was a marvelous profile of you in the New York Times Sunday Magazine, a copy which Knopf sent over. But for the benefit of our listeners and people perhaps who are just getting acquainted with you, perhaps you can give me some background as to why this particular era holds so much obsession and fascination for you.
Well, I was born in Los Angeles in 1948, the year of the rat in Chinese astrology, and I grew up there in the 1950s, obsessed by crime. A lot of kids read Superman or Batman or watched The Wizard of Oz on television. I watched crime noir and was obsessed with the doings of Mickey Cohen and the gangsters of that era. And also in 1958, when I was 10 years old, my mother was murdered. You know, simply put, a man picked her up in a bar and strangled her, and the killing was never solved. Shortly after that, I first heard about the Black Dahlia murder case, and later, of course, fictionalized it into my book, The Black Dahlia. So I've remained obsessed with L.A. during that era, and what I have done in the L.A. quartet is to give the reader what I think is an astoundingly detailed tableau of that time, concentrating on social history, police corruption, political corruption, major crimes of that time, fictionally transposed.
Well, of course, I'm not that familiar with that era, and you are. You've immersed yourself in the history of that period, the 40s and the 50s in Los Angeles. But what you've done in White Jazz is as a transitional technique to use newspaper clippings.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them seem real, and some of them, like the Hush Hush magazine, obviously is something you made up. But I really couldn't tell what was real and what wasn't.
Good. That shows I'm doing my job.
Yeah, because you intersperse real name, like William T. Parker, the chief of police.
Right.
Intermixed with the detectives who obviously were part of your imagination.
Yes. You've got real characters like Howard Hughes and the gangster Mickey Cohen and William F. Parker, the L.A. chief of police, and many fictional characters as well.
The thing that struck me as well, before I go into that, let's go back to the meshing of the real and the imaginary. One, you must have gone through scads of microfilm this period in your mind.
Only with The Black Dahlia, which is based on an actual case. The Big Nowhere, which is set in 1915, is about the Hollywood Red Scare of that time. I did no research. L.A. Confidential, the third volume of the L.A. Quartet, set in 51 to 58. I did no research. Everything is made up. I have been obsessed with that era for so long. I know so much about it just from having done casual reading and instinctive casual reading. Particularly that it's just there. I've been obsessed, and I transposed the obsession onto the paper.
Well, you really captured that period. I mean, that's hard to do.
Yeah, but I'm moving on now. And the book that I'm working on now is, well, let's just call it my Tet Offensive, what I've begun. You know, it might be an 8 Tet or a 10 Tet or a 12 Tet or a 14 Tet or as many Tets as it takes me to complete the project. But call it the Tet Offensive. No, these are unlinked books. What I want to do is recreate American history in the 20th century through crime novels.
Well, not all of America history.
No. Aspects of it. I'll draw from solely from my own imagination for some of the books and from history.
But your focus will probably always be Southern California.
No, it won't. I'm moving away from Southern California.
Where are you?
I'm bidding adieu. The book I'm working on now, American Tabloid, is, and don't wince because there are elements of this story that have been published previously and recently, I might add, but I'm doing the complete history of America from 1957 to 1968, the secret history. John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Marilyn Monroe, the mob, Jimmy Hoffa, the McClellan Senate Rackets Committee, the Appalachian Conclave in Upper New York State in 1957, the assassination of both Kennedy brothers. It's an epic for the whole family. If the name of your family is Manson.
That does sound like an epic. Are you going to have a single character to interweave?
No. There will be four first-person narrators carrying the action through 11 years.
Well, parenthetically, I know something about the difficulty in trying to recreate history, even relatively current history. I published a novel in 1988. St. Martin's Press published it, and it was set in 1948 in Baltimore and New York City, and its principal character was H.L. Mencken. So I had all of these, like you, I had all of these characters who were part real and part imaginary. Mm-hmm. But it was tough. I mean, I was a kid in 1948.
Yeah, it was the year I was born.
But I couldn't remember anything in 1948. Yeah. Not a thing. And I just had to go through history books and newspaper clippings and microfilm just to find out what movies were playing, what popular songs were going on.
Right. It was fun, though, wasn't it?
It was fun. It was after you, I don't know, maybe you could comment on this, but I found that after, it was hard looking at a blank piece of paper. It's kind of scary looking at a blank piece of paper. Once you have something down, you can go back and say, gee, I did that. Let me play with that a little more. And I've got an idea for fooling around with it and maybe introducing another character. And that seemed to me the real challenge is actually putting down a first draft. But then once you do that, playing with it, I thought was so much fun.
I begin with very, very detailed outlines. The outline for White Jazz, my new book, which is just out, was 164 pages. The outline for the book I'm working on now is 345. I know everything that has to happen. I know every plot twist and turn. I know every incident.
You remember it all?
No, that's why I write it down on an outline first.
Can you remember all of the details in White Jazz? So many things happen.
It's an extremely dense, dark, driven, stylized book. But yeah, I can remember just about everything in that book.
Your writing style is different from some of your other books. You have a very clipped writing style with very few complete sentences except where there is dialogue. Tell me about this approach.
It is, I would call it a stream of consciousness suited to the dark, violent events that the story tells. It is the first-person narrative of a very corrupt policeman named Dave the Enforcer Klein. He's a bag man. He's a gopher for the mob. He's in love with his own sister. He's not a nice man. He is a dark, corrupted soul. And you're seeing things the way he sees it. It is a straightforward, cohesive style, but it is very clipped, and thus it takes on a hallucinogenic quality. That is, I think, uniquely suited to what he is seeing.
Yeah. Do you see any heroes in YGS?
No. I don't go along with the old saw that in crime fiction you need a sympathetic character to engage the reader's empathy. I think that the same rules that apply to so-called mainstream fiction apply to crime fiction. If you have milieu, if you have style, if you have a strong point of view and deep characterizations, then you can create great art, and people will buy it.
Now, your principal character, the narrator of the book, is David Klein, who's a police lieutenant in the Vice Division. Now, as you mentioned a moment ago, here is a very unsympathetic character.
He has
absolutely no redeeming qualities whatsoever. And in fact, the book is, I think, as you mentioned, dense enough that we won't give away the ending. But he's really not punished. I mean, he has his share of violence, and he's beaten up and all this, but it's not, he really gets away. He gets away with murder.
Klein's punishment is knowing what he's done and knowing where he's been and knowing that there are no means of atonement. That's his punishment.
But does he care? There are people like that who don't care. They don't care what they've done.
He cares. He learns to care.
After all these murders, after all the hits that he's made, he learns to care.
Yeah.
After taking all these lives, after taking all this graft, after being on the payroll of Howard Hughes and everybody else, he learns to care.
He learns. It's a Pyrrhic victory. It's a compromise redemption. He's not absolved. He won't absolve himself. He develops too much self-honesty and candor in the course of telling the story to ever forgive himself.
Have you ever read John Gardner's book called On Moral Fiction?
No.
You ought to read it because Gardner would disapprove vehemently of white jazz, as he does or did. He's dead now. He was killed in a motorcycle accident. His book was quite controversial when it came out several years ago. He was quite critical of not necessarily white jazz in terms of the plot line. He was a man who believed in plot and story. He was quite critical of the, I guess they're called the postmodernist. These are people like Robert Coover and William Gass and John Barth, who often forget about plot and they play with the language. And often there are no redeeming qualities to the characters that they use. And his premise, if I'm not completely incorrect, and I'm not even sure I agree with it, but that was, believe me, it caused a big controversy in literary circles when it came out. His premise is that somehow fiction should be uplifting, and kind of like, if you think about it, remember in the 1930s and 40s where they had the Hays Office, where films were supposed to be uplifting at the end and not to show evil or sin or anything like that. And so in a way, Gardner believed that fiction should be like that.
I think my book is uplifting. Yeah.
Oh,
of course,
come on now.
It's true. No, it's true. It's true. Yeah. I am tremendous. You know, people have wept at the end of this book. They're so moved by it. Yeah. Many women, heterosexuals, homosexuals, blacks, whites, Republicans, Democrats, square Johns, hipsters. Yeah. I think it's a tremendously moving book and somewhat uplifting at the end. I would disagree completely, you know, with your synopsis of, you know, Mr. Gardner's thesis. Yeah. I think that a writer should write, I believe what Ernest Hemingway said, a writer should write what he wants to, the truth, or what he perceives to be the truth, in the way that he feels about it.
And I certainly agree with that. In fact, I had Gardner here, and we talked about just that subject, and I tried to grill him, and strangely enough, he had written the book about 2 or 3 years before I did the interview, and he took the opportunity in front of the same mic you're sitting in now to recant his theory.
Really?
He recanted it. He said,
I was wrong? God bless him. He said I was wrong?
I would never have published that book today because there are too many elements in it that I do not believe in. And
I wonder if he committed suicide. You know, he was dying of cancer.
No, I didn't know that.
At the time that he had his motorcycle.
Motorcycle crash.
Right, yeah. I wonder if he just let the motorcycle go out of control or did, you know, didn't do all that he could under the circumstances.
I don't know.
He'd had cancer for a while.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. He slipped on the big banana peel of life.
Yeah, really. In terms of your style, you, I think, to a certain degree, pay homage to those classic hard-boiled novelists like Hammett and Chandler.
Not so much Chandler. You know, I have recanted Chandler. I look through Chandler now, and boy, oh boy, and there's some nice passages, but I don't think he knew a whole hell of a lot about people. He certainly knew very little about the topic of men and women. Chandler grows in my mind, and James M. Cain grows in my mind. Chandler diminishes. But he did illuminate L.A., my smog-bound fatherland, with a great deal of verve. And I thank him for that.
This new book that you're writing is going to take you, to a certain degree, out of the crime genre, isn't it?
I'm out of the crime genre now, I think, in terms of pitch and characterization and certainly in style. And this will take me further out. It'll take me into the realm of the crime of American politics.
And your books have been getting increasingly more complicated, complex, haven't they?
Yeah.
Which I guess is a matter of building on your skills and experience.
I go to push the envelope each and every time. Yeah. I construct each and every succeeding book from the standpoint of how to make it bigger, better, richer, darker, deeper, more stylized, more profound.
Is it easier for you living here on the East Coast to look back at your native land, so to speak, because you can see it with the...
A few years ago, I would have said no. Now I would say yes. The quality of life has deteriorated in Los Angeles, and the older I get, and I'm 44 now, the more I appreciate simple, peace, quiet, the absence of noise, the absence of pollution, as much as you can find it in this country. And so Connecticut suits me just dandy.
But I was thinking in terms of writing, mm-hmm. that you might have a distance from it that might give you a better perspective.
Empirically, I found that I can write wherever I happen to find myself, and whatever my financial circumstances are or whatever my love life is like, I can just sit down and do it and expect the same quality each and every day.
Well, your financial situation has improved. You're not caddying anymore, are you?
I'm certainly not caddying anymore. I caddied for all you people out there in radio land who aren't familiar with my story. And why aren't you? I caddied up until the sale of my fifth book, yeah. I don't miss it. Yeah. I go by golf courses, and I see the caddies there, and I cross myself reflexively, which is particularly strange since I was raised a Protestant. But I do it anyway.
Well, maybe you're at the point now you can join a golf club and have your own caddy.
The trouble is I can't get the ball up in the air. And most of the country club food that I've eaten has been terrible and unhealthy. And it just doesn't vibrate my vindaloo, you might say.
So what's it like living? Where do you live exactly?
I live in New Canaan, Connecticut. And
very rural, isn't it?
No, it's off the Mirror Parkway. And it's suburban. It's far-flung suburban. It's quiet. It's peaceful. I'm married. I hang out with my wife and my ex-wife's dog. I think. I listen to the music of the German Romantic composers and a few of the Russians. And I work. And I promote the hell out of my books. And it's a good life.
The dog pictured in your dust jacket, is that your ex-wife's dog?
That's my ex-wife's dog.
What is that dog?
He's a bull terrier. Yeah, his name's Barko, B-A-R-K-O. He's a hell of a dog. Do you know the breed?
No, I don't.
They love all humans. The Spuds McKenzie dog from the beer commercials. They love all humans, and they dislike all other animals and go right for the throat. They are endlessly gentle and benign with human beings. They let kids beat up on them, but they do not like other animals.
Do you have visitation rights?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I see him all the time.
Why don't you get your own dog?
Because then Barko couldn't come over. Because I would only want to have a bull terrier and two bull terriers in the same room or anathema. I don't even know how these beasts breed.
Probably the usual way.
Yeah, I suspect that's true. I don't know how far we can go on AM radio.
I won't say it's strange because I know in divorce actions this does happen where one spouse will get visitation rights for the couple's dog, but it's kind of hard for me to imagine being attached to a dog to that degree that you wouldn't say, get your own dog and just forget the wife's dog.
Well, Barco's a handful, and the amount of time that I see him is just dandy with me, and I travel a lot, so everything has worked out for the best.
How often do you see Barko?
A couple times a month, 2-3 times a month.
Well, that's sufficient.
Yeah, Dad. Make it more often, Dad.
Where do you travel?
I go to promote my books all over the world. I don't like to travel unless I'm promoting my books. I don't want to do anything but work and promote my books. I have no desire to see the Taj Mahal, climb Mount Everest, see tourist attractions. I've been to Paris 7 or 8 times. I'm only there to promote my books. Whatever I happen to see out the window of my cab or my car or my train is dandy to me. I would only want to go to the top of the Eiffel Tower. You know, if they had a book party for me up there, then I could get people, harangue people into buying my books. Buy this book. Buy this book. Yeah. England, likewise. Italy. Germany.
Where are you being published?
Oh, all over the world. Yeah.
I noticed that White Jazz was first published in England.
It was first published in France. They translated first. It was just a fluke, was all it was.
I noticed in the copyright page it says first American edition.
Yes, it was published in France first.
Is that right? But, you know, there is. It's kind of interesting. You say write your books and promote your books. William Kennedy won the Pulitzer Prize for his novel Ironweed. He has an interesting phrase. He says, there comes a time to give the book its due. And that's what he does. He does the same thing. He likes to give his book its due. Isn't that a nice phrase?
Yeah, that is. That's a wonderful phrase. And what I feel, it's my gift to humanity. Yeah, I rather like people, and I enjoy going out there and meeting them in the course of promoting the books. And if I can hornswaggle or bludgeon or cajole or in any way coerce someone into buying my book, then of course I want to do it. And if they say no, they say no.
But it is kind of a nice feeling to be the attention of, be the focus of attention.
Well, what I like is, you know, I'm in the back nine of life right now, you know, not too far into the back nine, but in the back nine of life, or use a little bit of a golf metaphor. And someday I'll be gone, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, stormy weather cause your pump to rust. But these books of mine will be around. You know, I'm jockeying for a first-class plush cashmere-lined seat in the Pantheon.
Well, that's a good way to phrase it. But, you know, 44, I mean, you've got so many years ahead.
I know. You should write another book, have you?
I not only have, I wasn't able to sell it, but I'm working on another. It's just something that you do.
Yeah, it is.
I don't have the luxury of being able to work on it full-time, having a full-time staff job here.
Yeah.
But, work on it when I can.
Good,
and it's,
good.
It really, I think, is a fundamental part of wanting to create.
Yeah.
I mean, in the way that you phrased it.
Yeah, I have to do it. And they asked Stephen King once, well, why do you write these books, you know, these horrible books or dark books or whichever way they were described. And he says, why do you assume that I have a choice?
Say that again?
He said, why do you assume that I have a choice? And that's how I feel.
Do you hang around with, do you have literary pals or what?
Yeah, I have a few. Joseph Koenig is a friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Edward Bunker. A man who wrote the great crime novel, No Beast So Fierce. My wife's a writer. And I wouldn't call it a literary life. That sounds like something out of 1920s where you're hanging around drinking your brains out in Paris. But
there are some people who do it, though.
Yeah.
There are people hanging around William Styron, for example, and the people hanging around Tama Janowitz. There is a literary crowd.
It's
kind of amorphous sometimes. But,
yeah.
And there are other people who are just, they wouldn't know, some of them never met another writer. They just, and I, believe me, I do 2-3 interviews a week sometimes, and I met writers from all stripes. You know, and they, in a way, they're almost like everybody else. I mean, there is always a group. When you were in high school, or you probably saw a clique of people.
Right.
They just hung around.
Yeah.
The same type. Sometimes they were the football players, you know, or the nerds who were in chemistry and this sort of thing. Other people were just kind of lone people, you know?
Yeah.
In a way, I kind of think that's the way of writers, or just about like anybody else.
Yeah, I just think we're a microcosm of everybody else. Maybe a little bit more painfully sensitive and introspective. Maybe not.
Well, James Ellroy is great. Oh, by the way, before I let you go, the front cover of the dust show.
The front cover is great,
very
isn't
interesting.
It? Yeah, it's a Los Angeles Police Department police car shot full of holes. Yeah, it's a metaphor, but don't tell anybody. It's as timely as today's headlines, all you people out there in radio land.
It really is. How did you get that photograph?
The photograph was taken by a photographer named Robert Morrow, who takes a lot of interesting Los Angeles photographs.
That's an interesting one, all right.
It's a hell of a
your
photograph.
Wife, you said she's a writer. Does she...
She used to write. She used to be a journalist. She's writing a novel now. And she used to be a journalist writing for the L.A. Weekly. She was a columnist for the L.A. Weekly.
Do you compare notes?
Oh, frequently.
Is it helpful?
Yeah.
Kind of hard sometimes to deal with a spouse's work, though, isn't it?
She's brilliant. And thank God. And she has things to teach me. I'm just a bit more experienced.
Sounds like a good relationship.
Yeah, it does.
Well, White Jazz is certainly a a book that moves and gives you a lot to think about. It was written by James Elroy. James, thank you very, very much.
Good to be here, Don.